Again, this call is being recorded. If you do not wish to be recorded, you may disconnect at any time. If you would like to speak, you can virtually raise your hand by pressing 5-star on your dial pad. Again, that's 5-star on your dial pad. You will then be called upon in the order that your hand was raised. Please take a moment to enter your speaker code if you've not already done so. Please remember to also mute your phones until speaking. Good afternoon and welcome to a duly noticed meeting for the Stakeholder Advisory Board to the Governor's Office of Emergency Relief and Recovery. The Governor's Office for Emergency Relief and Recovery was created when Governor Sununu issued Executive Order 2020-06. That order is publicly available on the Governor's website. Today's meeting is an official meeting of the Board, is open to the public, and will be run in a manner compliant with RSA 91A. We have someone on the phone taking minutes, which will be posted to the Gopher webpage. Meeting materials for the Board and the public can be found by visiting the Gopher webpage at www.goferr.nh.gov. Again, that's www.goferr.nh.gov. And we're adding content to that website daily. Again, today's meeting is being recorded. I will help facilitate today's meeting. Because the Board is meeting by phone, under RSA 91A, there are a few initial logistics that we need before I turn it over to our chair, Donnelly Lozo. First, each of us must state our names, where we are located, and who is with us. As we move through our agenda today, each board member and anyone else speaking is asked to identify themselves before speaking. Should you choose to take any votes today, they must be done by roll call. We will now proceed with the roll call, and we'll start here with the Gopher staff. I am Joe Dorian, Deputy Director of the Gopher in the Gopher Office, 1 Eagle Square in Concord. I am joined by
Lisa English, Rhonda Hensley,
and we are all appropriately socially distanced in large conference room at the Department of Business and Economic Affairs. Now we're going to proceed with roll call of members alphabetically. Bill Ardinger.
Hello, Joe and everybody. This is Bill Ardinger. It's good to hear your voices again. I'm in my home in Concord, and I'm alone.
Thank you, Bill. Dean Kristen.
Good afternoon. This is Dean Kristen. I'm at my office in Bedford, and I am alone.
Thank you, Dean. Lisa Drabik.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Lisa Drabik. I'm at my home in Londonderry, and I am alone in the room.
Thank you, Lisa. Jim Jalbert.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Jim Jalbert. I am at my office in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and I am alone.
Thank you, Jim. Amy LaBelle. And both Donnelly and I received an email from Amy. Amy is participating in the reopening task force. She mentioned that she might join later, and I will check at the roll call again at the end just to double check. Al Letizio, Jr.
Hi, everybody. Al Letizio, Jr. here. I am at my office in Windham, New Hampshire, and I am alone.
Thank you, Al. Donnelly Lozo.
Afternoon. This is Donnelly Lozo, and I'm in my office in Manchester, and I am alone.
Thank you, Donnelly. Scott Mason.
Hi, this is Scott Mason. I'm at my farm office in North Stratford, New Hampshire, alone.
Thank you, Scott. Michelle McEwen.
Good afternoon. This is Michelle McEwen, and I'm in my office in Plymouth, New Hampshire, and I'm alone.
Thank you, Michelle. Nancy Merrill.
Hi, this is Nancy Merrill, and I am at my work office in Claremont, and I'm alone.
Thank you, Nancy. Jeffrey Myers. And Jeff Myers let Donnelly and I know that he might not be able to join the first hour of the meeting, but would try to hop on at the end. We'll proceed next to Holly Noveletsky.
Good afternoon. This is Holly Noveletsky. I'm in my office in Greenland, New Hampshire, and I'm alone.
Thank you, Holly. Kathleen Reardon.
Hi, this is Kathleen Reardon. I am in my home in New Boston. I'm alone.
Thank you, Kathleen. Benjamin Wilcox.
Hi, this is Ben Wilcox. I'm in my office in North Conway, and I am alone.
Thank you, Ben. Donnelly, with the roll call completed, Amy LaBelle and Jeff Myers are currently not on the call, but we are ready to continue, recognizing that we have a quorum.
Thanks very much, Joe. The next item on our agenda is a presentation from your shop at Gopher. In particular, the items listed on the agenda include the clarity on the December 31st spend compliance, if you have that information, the update on the Legislative Advisory Board, and the update on the Reopening Task Force.
Thank you, and I'm going to turn it over to Lisa. Go ahead, Lisa.
Thank you. So, unfortunately, Nancy Smith ended up being double booked, so we don't have we aren't able to have the discussion on the December 31st, 2020 spend issue. I will note that I don't actually have the document right in front of me, but it talks about expenses incurred during this time period. So I know one of the things that Nancy has been looking for and is hoping for as more guidance, the extent more guidance rolls out, is an understanding of a wind down of that program, should that be something that goes forward. But we will hopefully get Nancy in here for the next meeting, but unfortunately, like I said, she's on another conference call right now. I'm going to switch to the last part first, which is the Reopening Task Force update. And so an update as of from earlier in the week, there have been, the task force has agreed on proposals for a number of sectors, including hotel, outdoor attractions, and gyms. Those recommendations won't be final until public health officials and the governor give their okay. The task force recommended that most hotels be limited to half their capacity, and there's a recommendation for a reopening of May 22nd. For lodging, but targets for other sectors were not included. And our very own, or your very own, committee member, Amy LaBelle, is testifying before the task force this afternoon. So their work continues, and we will continue to provide updates as we get them. For the lab update, and this really folds into a Gopher update as well, we mentioned, I know, at the last meeting that the Legislative Advisory Board had completed its initial Excel allocation worksheet, along with a letter that they submitted to Governor Sununu. And to the extent there is time, I know that we're looking very closely at these recommendations and how that board has laid things out. And I think we'd be very interested in what your reflections on that letter and Excel spreadsheet are. I think other than that, I don't have any further updates. I'll hand it back to Joe.
Yeah, Donnelly, any questions or anything that we can provide a little clarity? And again, our apology, Nancy was asked to join with Director Little, a phone call with municipalities, and that's being conducted in coordination with New Hampshire Department of Homeland Security. So Nancy had to join the call to assist with some technical questions there. So our apologies to the board.
No worries. We appreciate the efforts. And, you know, if Nancy's not able to join, you know, if she just wants to write up a little bit of information that we can share with the board, you know, that would do it too. So if she can come on Tuesday, that would be terrific. And if she can't, she could just provide whatever she might know that might be an addition of what Lisa just said. That would be helpful. And if there aren't any answers yet, there aren't any answers yet. We get how that goes. I would just point out that we can ask the members about their input on the Legislative Advisory Board. I don't know if members have had a chance. So it might be helpful for them to have some time to look it over, and we can add that item to our agenda on Tuesday so that people can feel more comfortable giving a response. They've had their plates pretty full with information that we keep sending, so that might be a better opportunity if that's not a problem. Regarding the next item on our agenda, we begin with presentations. I'd like to thank Scott Mason for the work he's done on putting together today's group of presenters. And we'd begin today with Rob Johnson, the Director of Government Relations for the New Hampshire Farm Bureau. Rob?
Donnelly, this is Joe in the Gopher office. Rob, if you could press 5-star so we can find you and unmute your line. Again, 5-star. There we go. One second, Donnelly. We're just going to get him into the system. Apologize to the board members.
No problem.
Rob, go ahead. Thank you.
Hi, Rob. Welcome.
Thank you. Have you heard from Commissioner Jasper?
Actually, we've asked Commissioner Jasper to play wrap-up at the end.
Okay.
So if you wouldn't mind just kicking off, I'm sure you're able to do that without too much trouble. I'm sorry you didn't realize we were changing things up a bit.
That's okay. Thank you.
Right.
Thank you, Donnelly.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. First of all, my name is Rob Johnson with New Hampshire Farm Bureau. And Farm Bureau is a federation of New Hampshire's 10-county Farm Bureau organizations, consisting of close to 2,000 farm families with about 1,000 supporting business and other members. And we're a general farm organization. We represent farmers from all sectors, from dairy, fruit and vegetables, ornamental, maple, livestock, et cetera. And each of those organizations, they have their own commodity organizations that focus more on marketing. But one thing they do rely on Farm Bureau for is our legislative advocacy at the federal, state, and local levels. And as an organization, we have 3 full-time staff people, a part-time person, and we also provide support for the state's agriculture in the classroom program. And I'm the policy director, and I'm in my 19th year with the organization. We worked with Commissioner Jasper on our the ask for agriculture, and he'll be covering dairy, so I'm not going to touch on that, but I'll be touching on the other piece of agriculture, the all other, and that's primarily really made up of the fruit, vegetable, and ornamental sector. You know, it's still early in the season, and there are a number of unknowns, but there are certainly our concerns. And I believe you saw from the questionnaire that I submitted that we did get some data with the help of UNH Extension on the needs in response to the COVID-19 concerns and threat. And I guess one thing I want to start out with as far as this sector is give you a statistic. According to USDA, New Hampshire ranks number 1 in the nation for direct consumer sales as a percentage of total farm sales. And when we say direct consumer sales, that's sales from the farm, a farm stand, a pick-your-own operation, a community-supported agricultural operation, better known as a CSA to many of you, in a farmer's market. So these direct sales are very important to New Hampshire agriculture. And the issue that they're seeing is right now is just the increased cost in response to COVID-19. And just today, the Wall Street Journal carried an article and a headline in the business section, and the headline is, "In Food Delivery, Busy Doesn't Mean Profit." And our growers will tell you that. I had one particular four-season grower in the Seacoast who is his business has picked up significantly with everything that's going on, but he has told me that with worker and customer expectations that his cost, as he termed it, his costs are now a boatload increased a boatload with labor in particular going through the roof. And that's just what the study that we did as far as what growers are incurring up to this point and what they expect. And that is certainly, that's going to be an issue. Just recently, Extension and others have come out with guidelines, best management practices for UPIC operations, and that's what they're showing with their what they're suggesting is that there'll certainly be a greatly increased labor component as far as directing people and creating space and splitting tasks, where at one time, you know, you could, one person could handle checking people out and weighing through and directing people, where in what was before where one or two workers could do, you're now looking at three or four workers. You know, they're suggesting, for example, the idea is on when somebody's checking out, have one area where money is exchanged and another area where food is weighed, so that we require two separate workers. And it's all what it is. It's to the you know, to any funding would help keep workers and customers safe, and just to help maintain confidence in our state's food supply. Along with this, that's the primary section of the other agriculture, not including dairy. There's also our maple producers. They lost a very valuable time of the year and day and weekend and maple weekend, and that they rely on that. And I've cited some data in the questionnaire. And then there's also the agritourism side, and from what I understand from talking with the commissioner and conversations he had with the Department of Business and Economic Affairs, the Travel and Tourism Division folks, there'll be ability for agritourism enterprises to look there for funds. But there are other areas where we have suppliers that supply this industry, that where, you know, other funds could be utilized. And to give you one example there is we have a cut flower grower on the seacoast, and she's booked through every weekend through May into the fall. And as of right now, everything that she had booked for April, May, and June is canceled. Some of those have been rescheduled for the fall, but as I think, as we all know, who knows what's going to happen there. And just, we think that the best way for agriculture to receive help, most efficient, is through, as we're suggesting, through the funding to the Department of Agriculture, in which the utilizing the expertise and the know-how of the department, that could then make a recommendation to the governor as to where this money goes. And we're asking for flexibility in where that funding could potentially go. And I'll leave it at that and be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, much appreciated. Scott, would you lead us off?
Rob, could you explain how some farms, like in the hort business especially, may have concentrated their marketing on restaurants, and then with the close of restaurants, even though they're not impacted as far as their crop goes or the growing of the product, they've lost their market, and what that does to these farms and how they're having to remarket the products that they have?
Boy, I don't know if I can give you a good example. I mean, just that growers are geared to certain markets, and to, if there's just a switch of market in the time that would be required is I think a challenge for any industry, any sector.
Thank you.
Joe, are there questions from other members of the board?
And to raise your hand to ask a question, five star. Again, five star. And we have the first question from Michelle. Go ahead, Michelle.
Hi, thank you. I was noticing on the questionnaire that was submitted by the New Hampshire Farm Bureau that maybe it's the version I got, questions 6 through 8 were missing. So in question 6, very important, it's a question in regards to if you were to be assigned funds from this pot of money, how would they be utilized? Just talk a little bit about how you think the farms could use this money, in what ways they direct it.
Well, yes, I thought I touched on it with the fruit, vegetable, and ornamental sectors. It would be primarily labor, adjusting to the new responsibilities in keeping workers and people safe in response to COVID-19.
Okay, thank you. Do you see that they might change the direction of their business? I mean, I'm sure some of them are selling to restaurants that are closed, and we're seeing this in other parts of the food industry where now they're gearing more towards sort of marketing to the grocery stores. I mean, is there going to be a different focus on their market?
Well, there already is in many circumstances where, like I mentioned earlier, a grower on the seacoast, that where his focus is now more delivery, because that's what people are demanding. And certainly there will be a good deal of that. I know that the pick your own folks are very concerned in the guidelines that they're coming out and their expectations are, again, it will require just more workers to manage the flow. You know, you won't have these, as we've seen in the past, like an orchard on a weekend where they do a huge amount of their business if they're fortunate, 6 to 8 weekends in a year, and somehow that's going to have to be managed and require labor to space people out and if maybe people might have to call ahead and make a reservation, I guess you'd say, and all that. So certainly in that way, it's a certain change.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions, Joe?
5-star to ask a question. And it does not appear, Donnelly, that we have any hands raised.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Rob. Nice to hear from you. It's been a long time.
Thank you. Yes.
Next, I'd like to welcome Jim Titone, president of the Yankee Fishermen's Co-op and captain of the FV Fly Girls. Jim, floor is yours.
Well, thank you for listening to our spiel today and considering our proposal. The Yankee Fishermen Co-op, the need to establish a co-op was back in the late 80s. We had approximately 30 groundfish boats working out of Seabrook, Hampton, and Rye Harbors. And each one of these boats was an independent operator. Each captain of his boat was responsible for finding a place to load, unload, ship, and sell his product. So back in 1989, a bunch of fishermen got together, and they thought it'd be a good idea to form a fishermen's cooperative, which we did in 1989. The co-op offered these fishermen a one-stop for loading, unloading, and the co-op was also took the responsibility for shipping and selling each captain's catch. So that's what happened. That's how the co-op first originated. Over the years, because of government regulations and quotas, the number of groundfish boats has been dramatically reduced. Presently, we have 4 groundfish boats fishing fishing as members of the co-op. So we found the need to transition from a groundfish type of operation into a groundfish, lobster, and tuna operation. So right now, the majority of our business is lobsters. The co-op has approximately 70 members working out of various harbors here in the New Hampshire seacoast. We have approximately 30 non-members also operating out of these harbors and working through the co-op here in Seabrook. So that's what the history is on this this operation. This this COVID virus has created some major hardships for us. We have lost, entirely our wholesale business. And right now, we're depending upon a small retail market, which we have, to try to get us through. And it's been okay because the fishing has been pretty much reduced because of winter months. The fishing is, there's not much fishing going on. And we're able to handle what catches are being brought in between lobsters and groundfish. However, we're entering our busy season now. We have approximately maybe 5,000 to 7,000 lobster traps sitting here in our yard, and slowly but surely, all those traps are getting put into the water. So within the next month, we're going to be hit with a glut of lobsters, and we're going to need to find a market to get rid of these things, or else we may have to tell our fishermen that, you know, we don't have markets. Retail market right now is handling it, but in the future it may not be able to handle it. And we don't want to have to tell our fishermen that they have to reduce their fishing effort or stop completely because we can't move their product. And it's not that they're going to be able to go elsewhere to move their product because other dealers up in throughout the coast, Gloucester, Portland, up in Maine, they're experiencing the same problems, and they're going to be put under a tremendous amount of pressure as well from their fishermen up there to move product as well. Now, some fishermen have established dockside sales. Pretty good novel idea. But as soon as these lobsters start coming in larger numbers, this dockside sale may not be able to handle the quantity of lobsters coming in. So that's the some of the issues we're having with the lobsters. Now on the groundfish end of it, right now, like I said, we're down to 4 groundfish boats, and the 30 that we had originally, most of them have gone out of the business simply because of government regulations and quotas. You get a situation where the government tells you could only fish so many days a year, and you're limited to what you can catch. It makes it pretty much impossible for somebody to make a living doing this. So basically, people have been selling their boats and selling their permits. Now the permits being sold, a lot of them are being scooped up by large corporations who either are starting large corporate fleets or else they use these as income generators because they can take these permits and lease out the quotas to fishermen that are still fishing. So you can have, like say, for instance, I can go out and find somebody who has a permit and lease his quota for a certain dollar per pound. But what happens is, like last year, some cod permits were being leased out at $3 a pound. So these fishermen that bought those things for $3 a pound, they experienced the losses because the cod fishing prices were reduced to less than $3 a pound. It's like the $2.50 a pound. So basically they couldn't go out and fish because they were losing money on those permits. So in the future, to get into the business, these permits are really expensive, and to get into a fishing vessel, you're talking the minimum of $500,000 to get into a fishing vessel. So there's not any new blood coming into the business, and that's part of the issue here. And then the other part of the issue is the data that being put out by the National Marine Fisheries Service as to what stocks are sustainable. These numbers do not correlate to what's being actually caught by the fishermen. Right now, the haddock catches basically are unlimited for groundfish boats, but cod is either shut down or extremely limited. We had one fisherman here who started his cod quota in January. So by the end of January, his quota was caught up. So he wasn't able to go out fishing again for cod. So he had to re-rig his boat at good expense so he could start trying to fish for haddock. So it looks like right now, from what the fishermen are telling us, for every one haddock being caught, they're catching two codfish. And these codfish can't be taken in because simply because your quota's been caught or the area is closed to codfish. So these codfish have to be thrown overboard. Sometimes these things don't survive. So that's part of a bigger problem we have. And in the future, we're hoping that with the new executive order that got issued this past week by the president to streamline regulations, we're hoping that this does come into effect to streamline some of the regulations that our fishermen are now facing. In addition, there's some extensive bottom that's been closed off to any kind of commercial fishing. As under the previous administration, these areas were turned into national monuments. So now any kind of fishing is prohibited. So the people that had previously fished in those areas are now fishing other areas, causing more stress on other fishermen because now you're crowding into smaller areas to fish. And in the future, there's a great push to put offshore wind farms out into off the coast here in federal waters. These wind farms, they take up anywhere between 50 to 100 square miles of ocean bottom. And to be able to, you'll be restricted. There'll be no fishing, either recreational or commercial, allowed in these areas. And that's another threat to the industry. So it's a tough road to hoe right now as a commercial fisherman. I think the average age of our fishermen around here are probably well into their late 50s and early 60s. And hopefully we can get some changes in the whole way that things running through the government and get some younger people into this business, because there are a lot of younger people interested in getting involved in commercial fishing. So fishermen, we feel the fishermen can feed our citizens if the regulations are streamlined. Anyway, so that's what I have to say about the business here and what we're facing in the future, and I'd be happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Jim. Much appreciated. Scott, would you lead us off?
Jim, I got two questions for you. Since your written testimony, the money that's been put aside to help fishermen has been broken down by, I believe it was the agency, the federal agencies, NOAA. Could you explain how much money and how that will work, how much money that New Hampshire fishermen will be getting out of that fund? I believe in your testimony you had the national figure of $300 million.
Yeah, there was $300 million set aside for commercial fishing efforts in the CARES Act. Of that, New Hampshire's getting $2.7 million. Right now, it hasn't been determined how that money is going to be distributed. I know there's a committee being formed within the Fish and Game Department, and they're going to try to come up with a proposal to the Atlantic Marine Fisheries Agency that will distribute the money as to how we feel or how the state of New Hampshire feels it should be distributed amongst the fishing operations and individual fishermen themselves. So right now there is no answer on to how that money is going to be distributed.
How much money is coming into New Hampshire?
$2.7 million.
My other question, your ask of the committee is to help you folks create a comprehensive marketing and advertising plan. Have you put any thought into how much this, can you flesh that out a little bit more, and how much money do you think this will be?
Yeah, we've made some really early estimates on a new marketing plan, because right now, like I said, our international business with shipping of tuna and other products over to Asia is completely gone. We don't know if we're ever going to get that back again. And like I said, our wholesale business is gone completely. So we're trying to come up with a scheme on how we can establish a really robust retail market. The restaurants right now are pretty much shut down. We're not getting any of that business. So the marketing, we planned on trying to get a regional type of advertising and marketing campaign going to cover not only us, the commercial fishermen that work out of the Seabrook Co-op, but to try to enhance all commercial fishermen. And we've looked at rates from different types of media, print media, radio media, and television media to try to get some kind of campaign going. We're finding that with the exception of print rates, radio and television is pretty damn expensive. I've seen 30-second spots that can become available for $4,000 to $10,000, depending upon the time of day that you want your ad placed. Now, if on radio, I guess you can get an ad placed for $950, but that's in the middle of the night when probably nobody's even listening to the radio. And then you have to pay production costs to have your advertisement produced. And if you need spokesman to speak for your product or what you're trying to sell, you're going to have to pay extra money for that. We came up with a figure of close to $75,000 to $80,000 just in advertising alone. So that's strictly a rough guess based upon information we've been able to look up. We haven't got any firm numbers, but it just like I said, it's just estimates.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have about a minute left. Are there any questions from other members of the board?
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Al. Go ahead, Al.
Hi. Excellent presentation, Jim. I'm in the food business, so one of my comments, and I want to use this minute carefully here, maybe we can talk after the fact, but from reading through your presentation, reading through your information you presented, I gather that about 83% of your business is to the food service industry that's been radically impacted and about 17% to the supermarket industry or retail. I can tell you, being in both of those businesses myself, that the supermarket sales are up pretty dramatically. And if you have not explored that, there are we've got AG of New England here in New Hampshire. There are several retailers here in New England that wouldn't cost you anything to try to strike up a relationship with. I'd be happy to help you or make some connections for you if that would be of any help.
Well, we'd appreciate any help we can get and any leads we can get and where we might be able to move product. That would be
the supermarket
helpful.
Business represents more than 50% of the dollar spent on food here in New Hampshire or New England, so I would hope that there could be some avenues that could help you and keep things going. I don't want to use any more of the time. Thank you for your presentation.
Now we have we do sell to really large wholesalers who may also right now be involved in selling to supermarkets. So, but thank you for that offer. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for your response, and I'm sure that would be a very fruitful conversation with Al. And Al, I'll make sure I send along Jim's contact information.
Thanks.
Are there
that's
any
very
other
good.
Questions?
I appreciate
You're
that.
You're welcome. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very Donnelly, much.
We don't have any, Donnelly,
you.
We don't have
Thanks.
Any further hands raised.
Thanks, Joe. Next on our presentation list is Jason Stock, the Director of Government Relations for the New Hampshire Timberland Owners. Jason?
Well, good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Good afternoon.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for the opportunity to come and testify or speak before you. New Hampshire Timberland Owners Association, we represent the state's timberland owners in the broader forest products industry. We have about 1,300 members, and about half of them are what you would consider a kind of a tree farmer or timberland owner. The other half are businesses that are engaged in forest products. And it's everything from loggers and consulting foresters to sawmills, paper mills, and biomass wood chip power plants. Forestry is a pretty big business in New Hampshire, particularly, say, west and north of Manchester. We are the state's or the nation's second most forested state, and our industry represents about $1.6 billion in annual economic activity. In preparation for this, I and some folks from Cooperative Extension did a survey of members, particularly sawmill, those in the wood processing side of things, as well as landowners and loggers, to get a sense on what the impacts we're seeing from COVID. And what we've discovered is that although the forestry and forest products was deemed an essential industry by the federal government and many state governments, COVID is having a significant impact. And what we're seeing is this impact is really going to come to bear in the next month as we come out of mud season and loggers and start getting back into the woods, trying to move wood, trying to move product, and sawmills ramping up production. It's really the impacts are going to be even more hard felt then. The trickle-down effect that we're seeing is hitting us both on domestic and foreign markets. A lot of New Hampshire timber and lumber goes to Canada and to other states for furniture manufacturing, flooring, things of that nature. And, of course, many of those facilities have been shut down, idled, or have been kind of greatly reduced output due to, social distancing and having to manage their shifts and work schedules. And so we've seen it on the domestic level with facilities, Canadian mills. The other interesting piece we've seen is that on export markets, a lot of New Hampshire timber gets exported to the Far East, and the Middle East and Europe. And as COVID has impacted shipping and international, shipping out of ports, that has had an effect on, those markets and the ability to move product. And of course, those manufacturing in those countries are also being impacted. And then lastly, construction. As everyone knows, construction is down. You use lumber to build houses, things of that nature. We're seeing it there. The other piece, so we've seen a decrease both in demand for supply, for volume, but it's also been reflected in lower prices. This, of course, is affecting sawmills, but it also affects, it trickles down to the logger and then how much they can get for the logs they cut, and also ultimately to the landowner for how much they can get for stumpage or the trees that they sell. Logging, we estimate about a 20% reduction in value. Sawmills, another, a reduction on the order of about 55 million. Landowners, about 4.8 million. Again, this is looking at the last 3 months that we've been dealing with this, with these markets and this kind of unusual circumstances. The expectation is as loggers get it back into the woods here in the next several weeks, as things dry out, it's going to be, the issues are going to become even more acute. So this is, it was a good exercise going through this, through the questionnaire. It asked, about the problem. I think we've done a fairly good job at trying to identify and quantify it. During our surveys, we also asked about solutions and what would folks want to see for solutions or assistance. There were some very kind of standard key tenets that came out. And I think they align with what you folks are working on, accountability, using existing infrastructure program or agencies, and certainly providing relief to any existing facilities, and at the same time, to the extent that we can stimulate new or stimulate economic activity, that's also a desired outcome. And to that extent, instead of direct payments, things of that nature, the suggestions that came out were, number one, look at the existing fees and taxes paid by these businesses. There's a number of them that you say, all right, is there a way to develop kind of a rebate? So if I pay my, I pay my air emissions fee or my stormwater fee or my truck registration fees, look at establish a mechanism where you could just essentially provide evidence or proof of that and get a rebate for that. The other piece is that came out in our interviews was the Paycheck Protection Program has been very helpful, particularly to the sawmills and any logging contractors with more than 5 employees. There are a lot of single owner operators out there. They didn't participate, but the larger crews, larger companies did, and they have found it to be very, very helpful. Couple mills and processing facilities said anything we can do to increase the amount of testing, we're pleased to see that increase, and anything we can do to continue to push that, increase the availability of testing is helpful. And then employment. Employment was an issue that came up many, many times throughout the interviews. And I think we heard it in some of the earlier testimony today, attracting and retaining employees. I've heard from mill members saying, look, this is less of a dollar amount and almost as much a policy issue when you have scenarios where it's difficult to retain employees when you have unemployment benefits exceeding what the going wages are, and at the same time, to the credit of employees, you have employees also that are concerned about their health, and for that matter, the increase in testing would be beneficial as well. And then the other piece on kind of the stimulus side of the equation, looking at if there are opportunities to look at ways to provide low interest loans, things of that nature. Again, that would be a situation where you could use what the legislative side of this Gopher committee is looking at is, the BPA and some of those, they create funds there for assistance. Perhaps there's opportunities in that arena to look at low interest loans, things of that nature. I'll conclude my comments at that. You have our written testimony. Be happy to try to answer any questions. And again, thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you so much. We appreciate your presentation, and we appreciate looking at it from all the angles that we asked you to look at it from. Very helpful. With that, Scott, do you mind leading us off?
Jason, do you have any idea on this loan fund how much money would need to be allocated to that?
I don't have a dollar amount. What I can tell you is, if you're looking at a timber harvesting operation where, a single operation where they've had to shift markets, shift production, and kind of retool their, how they do business, you're looking at a capital expenditure, $1.5 to $2 million if they're kind of retooling how they operate. And that's a single operator, single operation. Granted, that's a high end. And also on the scale of sawmills, again, you know, if they're having to retool or rework their inventory programs because of COVID-related, you know, hangups and how they have to manage inventory, you know, you're looking at, I'd say, you know, $1 million easily at that point for kiln and storage capacity. So, you know, all in, you wanted to do something that was kind of modest, kind of out of the gate, you know, a $20 to $30 million program would be enough to provide a meaningful impact and at the same time help, you know, I'd say easily a couple dozen businesses. And again, we would suggest you'd make it a competitive type grant program where you would go in and, you know, the state, you'd have a competitive program, have folks make applications, and at the same time provide a business plan to show that, hey, this is not just a money grant, that we are going to do this, and this is going to equate to jobs, increased efficiencies, et cetera.
One more question. In your survey, were you able to come up with any kind of a figure on loss of sales, you know, due to the, I mean, a lot of the surrounding states around us have shut down construction. That has got to have an impact on our sales, knowing how timber's marketed. Were you able to figure out a figure there?
Yeah, when we look at sawmills, when we did kind of a back of the envelope survey, again, this was not an in-depth kind of doctorate thesis. This was a survey done. We looked at, you know, an impact on the export market of about $11 million, and then another $44 million impact on kind of general production. And so that's your lumber sales. And that loss, as I mentioned earlier, that starts to trickle down to your loggers and your landowners, reflected in both volume consumed as well as dollars paid per board foot.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Jason. Are there questions from other members of the board? We have a couple of minutes left.
Again, that's 5-star to raise your hand. Again, 5-star. Hi, Donnelly. We have a hand raised from Holly. Go ahead, Holly.
Thank you, Jason. I think you did a really nice job laying out recommendations. I especially like the tax rebate on fees. I have a question. I think it's probably more for Donnelly than actually you. You mentioned something that's come up repeatedly in these presentations, and that's the paycheck protection needing to be extended. Is that something that we have any input on? And maybe that's a question for the board, but that seems to be a recurring theme.
Thank you, Holly. Jason, I'd hate to put you on the spot unless you think you know the answer and would like to take a shot at it.
The only thing, and I'll let you speak to it in more detail, the only thing I would suggest is that to the extent that anyone, can advocate for that, that would be helpful. And so as a board, as an entity, letters of support, things of that nature, I would advocate, you know, that would be anything I think would be helpful at this point.
Thank you. Holly, I'll respond to that in just a minute. I just want to make sure there aren't any other questions for Jason.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions, Joe?
Donnelly, it doesn't appear that anyone's raised their hand.
Great, thank you. And thank you, Jason. Much appreciated. As far
You're
as
welcome.
Thank you. As far as the response relative to the payroll protection plan, I don't think that we have any ability, nor do I think the state has any ability to extend it. It's strictly a federal program outside of the CARES Act, is my understanding, and I am happy to be corrected should I be wrong. I do think Jason's point about collecting the information that we have, which many people have mentioned, including Jim Gelbert on one of our first conversations about what if it went out during your reopening for a period of time, how would that help, and getting a positive response from that. I would think that advocating for that to be considered would be something that individual members could do, or the board if the board felt that it could do it. I would point out that I think our role as a board is to recommend to the Gopher Committee, and where it goes from there, you know, it would be up to them and the governor. Doesn't preclude us from being individuals, and many of us knowing our delegation members on the federal level that might want to hear that. Now, if I'm incorrect on any of that, Joe or Lisa or Bill, if you want to weigh in before we recognize Commissioner Jasper, that'd be fine.
I agree with you, Donnelly.
Okay. Then I guess we got the right answer. Go ahead, Joe.
Donnelly, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we have a hand raised from Jim Gelbert. I don't know if this is related to this conversation or not, but I just wanted to recognize him. Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you.
It actually is. Real briefly, Donnelly, in the CARES 4 version that was the speaker introduced, some of the PPP issues were actually rectified. And so I think that Congress on both sides and on both sides of the aisle have recognized that there are some flaws with it. Now, whether we get a CARES 4 or not, who knows? But I think that there is progress has been made. Thanks.
Thanks, Jim. Joe, is the board clear?
Donnelly, we have some discussion, which is great. Lisa, go ahead, Lisa.
Thank you. I just wanted to basically echo what was just said. I actually had the opportunity this morning to talk to Congressman Chris Pappas. We did a Coffee with Chris session, and we asked him about this particular issue, and he indicated that it has been addressed, at least in the current version of CARES 4. So hopefully those PPP issues will be addressed going forward, but of course we all know we don't know how that's going to turn out. So thanks.
Thanks, Lisa. Appreciate the input. Anybody else, Joe?
Donnelly, doesn't appear that we have any further hands raised.
Okay, great. With that, I am pleased to welcome Commissioner Sean Jasper from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Foods. Commissioner Jasper.
Good afternoon, Chairman Lozo. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. It's my pleasure to be with you this afternoon. I think that Rob Johnson did a very good job of covering the issues that everything other than dairy is facing. The dairy situation, hopefully most of you know, has been bleak for quite a while, with some improvement last year. And of course, Scott can really run circles around me when it comes to this issue. I rely on him very often for advice in that area to begin with. But so I understand full well that we can't make dairy farming profitable through this. All we can do is hope to mitigate the effects of the COVID crisis. So that's what I've looked at specifically. And I think that most people I've talked to agree that if we are not able to help dairy in New Hampshire, probably two-thirds of the farms are in danger of going out of business. Some of them did take advantage of an insurance program, which has not always been something that's been a financially good thing to do. It's going to turn out to be that way this year. So I've looked at all those factors. We know that there is potentially money coming from the federal government to go directly to dairy farms, but unfortunately we still don't know how much that's going to be. So my analysis, given the current milk prices and taking nothing else into account, is that dairy farmers stand to lose about $5.2 million through the end of this year due to COVID-19. And that's a pretty substantial number, but we need to provide that help, and most people in New Hampshire certainly understand the value of keeping the lands open. Each cow on a farm keeps about 2 acres open, and so that's a substantial amount of land. There's about 12,000 milking cows in New Hampshire the last time I took a look at that number, and that changes on a pretty regular basis. So that's what we're looking to do, is to mitigate those losses and take into consideration all the other factors. On the fruit and vegetable grower side, the greenhouses and cut flowers and nurseries, it's really impossible for us to know exactly what those costs are going to be. And this is different because it is cost versus the losses. And some people have the ability to raise their prices marginally to take care of or to cover the additional costs, but that's not always possible to do that, to recoup 100% of their costs. Rob worked with Cooperative Extension to do some survey work. It had to be done very, very quickly, and we got some responses from large growers. But by extrapolating those numbers, we think the potential costs for New Hampshire growers could be somewhere in the vicinity of $2.5 to $3 million, but that's just our best guesstimate. So, you know, that's in the range of what we're looking for, what we think there are going to be losses, and particularly as we move forward, things could change very rapidly. So none of these numbers are really cast in stone. They're just, you know, a snapshot in time. I think I'll leave it with that and try to answer any questions that anybody might have.
Thank you, Commissioner. Much appreciated. Scott, would you like to lead us off?
Sean, this $5.2 million loss, that's based on price alone and not based on the quota systems that the two co-ops have instituted in response to COVID-19, correct?
Well, I updated the numbers today, and I did have conversations with one of the haulers. New Hampshire was producing about 19.5 million pounds of milk a month. So we backed that down to take that into consideration to 19 million pounds. Again, no idea how close that is going to be, but probably in the ballpark. And then simply looked at what the forecast for milk prices were before COVID started and what they were as of Tuesday to come up with that $5.2
million. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from other members of the board?
Again, 5-star to raise your hand, 5-star.
Joe, while you're watching the board, Commissioner, I have two questions that that I maybe should know the answers to, but I want to make sure. One is your department is capable, if given funds through GOFER, the governor, to distribute funds. As you know, we're taking an approach of existing entities that can be distribution places to get money out so that we don't have a problem getting things out of a single place. That's something that your department is able to do?
Well, if you'd asked me that question Friday, I would have said no, because we hadn't received a waiver to hire our one and only accountant. We've since got that waiver, and I'm now confident that we can process the paperwork to get the checks cut by the state treasurer. And I want you to all know just what scope this is in terms of what we're looking at. Our budget is about $6 million a year at the Department of Agriculture, and about $3 million of that is federal funds. and other funds. So, you know, this is essentially doubling the amount of money that we would normally process in a year. But I think we can manage, and we will manage
okay.
it.
Fair enough. And then maybe I should have caught this, but there's just so much information coming at us from so many different places, and sometimes you wonder how applicable it is to New Hampshire. But the conversation around food product that's going to go to waste or not be grown, or milk that's being thrown away, that sort of thing, do you have concerns about that happening here in New Hampshire?
Not a great deal of it. Now, I just had a conversation with one of the milk haulers, and things have balanced out. There's only really two milk haulers, and they each handle not quite 50% of the products, each company. But the one, Dairy Farmers of America, told me they had not had to dump any milk since last Tuesday, so the situation on that hasn't improved. In terms of the other products, I think we do such a good job with selling directly to consumers, as Rob said, that I don't think we're going to see a lot of that. Now, I had a conversation with one greenhouse operator, very small, but they were providing all the greens to a big restaurant here in Concord Conference Center, and they've had to shut down production because they totally lost their client, if you will. And so that's the only one I've heard of in that regard. I know there's been a concern with farmers markets, whether they're going to be allowed to open up or not, and that would certainly create a problem. We're working very diligently on that. The governor's office has been helpful in clarifying the rules there in terms of how many people they could have at a facility. So I think we're managing pretty well, and I don't think that we're going to see those problems at states that are really putting their food products into the big institutional areas. They're having huge problems. I don't foresee those in New Hampshire.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Joe, any questions on the board?
Donnelly, we have a question from Bill Ardinger. Go ahead, Bill.
Hello, Commissioner. Thank you very much for taking the time to come speak with us.
Of course.
I had two questions. One is it again, and I may have missed this, but could you just confirm for me the amount of money that, based on your current preliminary assessment of the needs of your responsible the area for which you're responsible, the amount of funds that you think could be properly and usefully deployed between now and the end of the year, number one, and could you, and I think you were saying, I'm not sure, I want to get that number confirmed. And the second thing is there any way you can give us a little bit further information about how you reached that number, what kind of data you were looking to come up with that thought? And then I guess the final question would be, if the money gets to the department so the department can manage the distribution out to the businesses that are supposed to get it, how do you feel about providing grants that have conditions or loans that might be paid back if businesses were able to, over a long period of time, pay it back? Those are my three, and thank you very much, Commissioner Jasper.
You're welcome. So, in total, the dairy situation was looking much worse a few weeks ago, but right now, if you were to say what's the maximum that you think is reasonable, would probably be up to about $8 million. But again, the 5.2 is the hard number without taking into consideration insurance and things like that. The great unknown is how much labor is going to have to be added. How I came up with the dairy numbers are very easy, actually, because we actually know the actual production numbers. We know the forecast that is put out by AgriMark for the upcoming year. So they do it on a calendar basis, so I have all that data. So we know what they were forecasting prior to the COVID hitting. We know what they're forecasting now. We know production, and that's a simple math equation. The fruit and vegetable growers was much more difficult and had to be done very quickly. And so that was a survey that was sent out that Cooperative Extension put together working with Farm Bureau. And they had, I think, something like about 20 farms responding, and those were some of the bigger growers. Their high-end estimate just for those 20 farms was a little over $500,000 that they were projecting. And so then we just, you know, looked at how, we don't really know how many farms we have. We have set a floor of $50,000. If you don't produce $50,000 worth of produce, we said, well, you know, there's already the $1,200 that everybody's getting. You're really not making a living if you're producing less than 50,000 gross. So sort of looking at the numbers forward and doing just somewhat of an educated guess as to what the extreme might be. And so, you know, when we went to the legislative committee, we were, you know, looking at an ask, or, you know, saying that, again, we were right in that $8 million range. In terms of, your last question, Bill, I'm sorry.
It was grants versus loans.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Yeah, we're not set up to do that at all. I mean, we have processed, for instance, there was a drought relief bill for dairy farmers a few years ago. This department processed that. We can make grants. We do that, you know, all the time, and that's essentially what this is. But in terms of setting up a loan program with any way to figure out how to repay that, that's not something that we're capable of doing. The commissioner's office is myself. I have an administrative assistant, an accountant, and a half-time human resources person, and that is the extent of the administrative offices of the Department of Agriculture.
Understood. And I thank you very much for answering those questions, and thanks for your presentation again.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Joe, any other questions?
Donnelly, it does not appear that we have any further hands raised.
Great. Thanks so much, Commissioner Jasper. I appreciate your time.
You are welcome.
All righty. Next item on our agenda is the discussion regarding our recommendations. Everybody should have received, and I hope have had a chance to take a look at our revised template that we had discussed on Tuesday. I will note that somehow, I didn't catch it till now, that under Sector D, where it talks about enterprises for nonprofit, it should also have a line, just like Section C does, that says support business advisory capacity to address COVID-19 harms, and should then in the column with potential implementing agencies point out the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits, who is the nonprofit version of supporting entities to help people apply for funds with their best foot forward. So I would just suggest that that be added unless there's objection. But I'm pretty sure I've been discussing that from the beginning, so I don't know how I missed it. But with that, I would thank everybody for all of their efforts. I really received some great comments, and Bill and I went through them, and we think we have captured all of the concerns that we discussed on Tuesday, and emails from individual members that brought things to light. You'll notice that we also did break out the timing and the priority in an effort to help clarify what we mean by highest, higher, and high, as well as what's been completed to our knowledge, what we believe should be done immediate, which matches highest, and then later round and next round, you will see in there as well. So I'd love to open it up for any input.
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Scott Mason. Go ahead, Scott.
Sorry, Donnelly, I just wanted to make a comment before we finished up with the ag.
Oh, sure.
I am starting to get some information from the horse industry in New Hampshire, and I will be presenting that in written form as I receive it. I just wanted to forewarn the committee that that still seems to be out there and coming in now. Thank you.
Welcome.
Donnelly, we have a hand raised. Oh, sorry. We have a hand raised from Holly.
Thank you.
I just have two comments. First, under F, healthcare, and the reimbursement for non-healthcare providers, physicians, behavioral health, dentists, et cetera, that's on the next round, and I think that needs to be moved up to the immediate. So much of primary care and diagnostics has been put on hold, and the providers need to gear up to be able to provide that care safely under the new recommendations, and I think postponing the reimbursement there, that's one thought. And the second one was under G, under human services, with child care, the recovery and reopening phase is also put off to next round, but we can't really open up sectors without having appropriate child care, and just thought that that needed also to be moved up to immediate. Those are my two thoughts.
Well, thank you. The one on healthcare, certainly we can recommend changing that. As far as child care goes, I agree with you, but what we followed here is, I don't know if you had an opportunity to read the letter that Associate Commissioner Tappan sent out. I sent it out to members. I can't remember if I did it last night or this morning. And we followed her recommendations, and they do have a substantial they have had a substantial opportunity to get funding out to people to help them with that already. So we were just following her recommendations there.
In her recommendations, I thought that she put it into three phases, the emergency, the recovery, and then with the reopening.
The last phase was build it back better. Yep, yep. So that's what we're following. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I just thought there was an intermediate phase that needed to be a little bit more urgent, but okay.
No, I think we've got it. And you know, the other thing, too, is recommendations, things change. We send it to Gopher, the governor. They hear from DHHS that things have changed. They need more money or they need to pivot. I think this gives them enough flexibility to do that. It's one of the reasons that I think it's so important that DHHS and the Department of Ed, you know, and the partnership they've already been working with, continue on the path they're on. Because I think they're closest to the ground of the folks that they're working with and have built a lot of faith and confidence with people.
Absolutely. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Further discussion?
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Nancy. Go ahead, Nancy.
Hi, I'm going to apologize in advance because I think the answer to this question is probably obvious. As we continue to hear testimony, then I'm looking at our spreadsheet here and sort of making sure everything has a place. And listening to today's presentations, where do our Fishermen's Co-op and Timberlands drop into here? Are we looking at them as agriculture in a really broad sense, even though they're kind of not, or are we looking at those as a regular nonprofit, as in grants or loans through BFA or RDCs?
I think they can fall in all those categories. I think
okay.
they can fall into C, and they can fall into D, and they can fall into ag if the governor or somebody thinks it makes sense for it to go through there.
Okay.
But I think we're trying so hard not to get too specific so people don't wonder, where do I fit?
Right.
So,
but I do want to, I just want to make sure at least there's sort of a place for everybody. And my second question on the implementing agencies, clearly our list is not exhaustive. And I'm wondering if that, I mean, there are other intermediaries and mediators and others that sort of should be part of some of this. So are we going to note that somewhere?
Yes.
Okay.
So it's our, maybe this will help the board to know kind of how, what direction I'm trying to get us to is, if we can get this document in a way that we all feel comfortable that there's a fit for, you know, any entity that comes along, profit, nonprofit, large, small, medium, you know, whatever it is, healthcare, housing, if they find a place within this framework, I think that that's the first thing we want to make sure of. The
yeah.
second is I think we want to make sure that we're making it clear that we are recommending that it not just be the state getting these dollars out, that we want to spread that around, have entities that have a history and expertise in getting dollars out the door to participate in doing that. We want to make sure that the supporting entities, whether it's a Center for Nonprofit, SBDC, whoever it might be, you know, even looking in the in Section G, Human Services, there are a lot of supporting entities that are going to be necessary for successful reopening operations moving forward as it relates to human services, as it relates to education. So what I'd like to do is once we get this document to where we all feel good about it, then we should draft a narrative letter that explains what our thinking is about the framework, about how we think people fit in. And I'm hopeful then our result of that will then be that we basically stand down as a committee and stand ready for whether Gopher or the governor asks us to look at something again, to look at things differently, to take on a specific task, to get more testimony from a specific industry, whatever that might be. And we, of course, can still keep receiving written testimony from people to consider and make part of the public record. That, in my mind, is where we're the direction I'm trying to move us in. And, again, making sure that our purpose, which is give Gopher the information they need to make recommendations, has gotten to a level that satisfies what they need right now.
Okay.
Hopefully that helps.
That does. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Michelle. Go ahead, Michelle.
Hi, thank you. Just a comment and a question. My first question is, where it says completed, is that indicating that the funding is done? For example, I look at reimbursement local governments for non-FEMA covered cost. I know it's on the radar, but because we're not at the end of this, I'm not quite sure it's really completed. So I just want to understand what the word completed meant here, or what was intended.
I think Bill and I will probably both pipe in, but the completed term means money has been distributed in those categories and to those entities.
And if there's additional costs that they are not considered again, or
no,
I just wondering, is the door closed?
Yeah. I don't think so. Bill, do you want to weigh in?
Yes, I would say that you're right. It's either they've been distributed or identified by the governor already as amounts to go out, in this case, $40 million to the local government. And then, Michelle, the next line, further reimbursement for
mm-hmm.
non-FEMA COVID costs, that is space for what I think we all expect will be additional COVID impacts that will be suffered by municipalities.
Okay, great. Thank you. And just to follow up on the previous comment about the potential implementing agencies, you know, we've got DHHS on a lot of these and just don't know whether there's the capacity with everything else they're dealing with to do that and whether or not there should be some options also for not-for-profits. I mean, we did hear from HEFA. They have, they believe, a structure and capacity to do that and whether we should include them as potential agencies in some of these areas.
Okay. DHHS, I think, as it relates to the human services part, I'm quite confident that the systems are in place there. And remember, DHHS has so many different bureaus within it. And so different people there are doing different things. Like the USDA group, you know, manages getting their money out the door through that system. And the child care folks manage getting that out through their, you know what I mean? Might they need more capacity in the financial shop and making sure that the accounting is all there for this level? Likely, but I would imagine that they would make the case of what they might need to help there. But I think DHHS is also quite capable of identifying other distribution entities if they think that it makes sense. It's one of the reasons that DOE is on there, because I think that they can help in some ways as well.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. I keep saying, Joe, how the board looks. I don't know if it's a board. I've never seen it, but...
Donnelly, it's a very low-tech board, but... it does, giving it a moment to catch up, there are no, currently no hands raised.
Great.
Oh, actually, I've just been made a liar. I apologize. We have a hand raised from Kathleen Reardon. Go ahead, Kathleen.
Joe, I think I was raising just as you were saying that. So you were on point. I just wanted to say, I think that this framework accomplishes what we were hoping to do in terms of highlighting the priorities. I think in reflecting on what we've done, adding the timing piece is helpful. I think it was, I don't remember if it was Holly's or Michelle's comment about there are different places for organizations to go, and there will be a little bit of self-selection in some cases to determine if they would like to go to BFA to pursue a loan or a forgivable loan or to go another route. I think to the extent that we could recommend that this framework be used in a way to help help guide people as well. And so by that, I mean the agencies that are involved, you know, may in some cases, like the BFA, their knowledge of other resources that are available, or like the supporting agencies, their knowledge of other resources that are available, and to the extent that the Gopher Office can, I think we've got this recommendation at the top of the sheet that Gopher has a single information site that directs to those portals could be helpful.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Ben Wilcox, and again, it's 5-star to ask a question.
Hi, I just want to, Donnelly, to start with saying I really like this format. I think you guys have done a tremendous job putting this together and synthesizing everything we've been reviewing, so kudos there. You had mentioned earlier on under the nonprofit, the NHLA maybe picking up some of the nonprofit category. Could you elaborate on that? I'm trying to get a little better understanding of those intermediaries. I know a lot about the charitable foundation, but I just wanted to see how everything would balance there.
Sure, no problem. And my apologies if there was any confusion. So the under nonprofits, the bill capacity at NHLA is the New Hampshire Legal Assistance or Legal Aid, whichever people refer to it different ways. They're kind of the only organization that does that kind of work. What I was trying to add to that section is the same thing that you see under C for supporting business advisory capacity to address COVID-19 harms, because as you'll see there, we've added, you know, other organizations that so they'll help somebody put an application together so they have their best foot forward. And what I was trying to add to the Nonprofit Center is actually Kathleen Reardon's shop, which is the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits, which is really one of the only organizations that I'm aware of that exists solely for the purpose of supporting nonprofits to, in essence, be their strongest that they can possibly be in order to deliver the diverse services that they do throughout the state, and not just in the social service world, in so many other ways, including the arts and, you know, pretty much anything that you can think of. And so I wanted to make sure that we didn't miss them as a supportive entity, because what I'm thinking is we want to make sure that people understand that there's a place to go. So my husband and I owned a few restaurants back in the day. I've gotten over it, but just barely. And, you know, when you go to the bank with your, you know, handout saying, here's what we're thinking, you're going to have a much better response from the bank if you come in with a well-thought-out business plan. And for a first-time business owner, that's a challenge. They may not know that going in. What I think there's an opportunity here for is, one, making sure that everybody goes in with their strongest plan that talks about, you know, what they've been through, just like our questions, right? What's happening right now? How are you hurting? What can we do to help you recover? And then what's going to help you be stronger in the long term, particularly if something like this happens again? And so that's all I was trying to do. And knowing that there are entities out there is helpful. Having somebody say to you, geez, have you talked to the Small Business Development Corporation to take a look at, you know, what you might want to put on your sheet, or you considered everything in your plan? And the same for the Center for Nonprofits. They're the group that makes sure that your governance of your board is done correctly, that you have understandings of how audits work, and you know, what your finances and profit and loss should look like for all different kinds of entities. It's a good learning environment. So that's all I was trying to do, and I think that fits in multiple categories. And just making it clear that we want them to help, and that people are welcome to go to them, and that we want to support the capacity for those helping entities to be able to serve that purpose.
Perfect. Thank you.
Does that help? Okay. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Joe, anything else?
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Bill Ardinger. Go ahead, Bill.
Hello again, and great question, Ben. I wanted to confirm that New Hampshire Legal Assistance with NHLA that you focused on, you know, Donna Lee mentioned the advisory component, which is a new line that was omitted inadvertently, but the NHLA is important, and I wanted, you know, it's helpful to think about the entire sheet that we've been working on as trying to find places in our New Hampshire economy where state government and its programs could fit in and try and stall the deterioration of economic and social relationships that we depend on in our state, and they are at risk of deteriorating, as we all know, due to this virus situation. NHLA, the grant that is suggested to them here to build surge capacity, to build a network of additional support, is designed to deal with precisely one of those potential failure points. It is fair to expect that as some of the executive order, governor's executive order protections are terminated. Like, for example, no foreclosures or no evictions. That, you know, while I expect that, you know, 85-90% of our landlords and our mortgage lenders will be fair and continue to be sensitive to their borrowers and renters, there is a pretty good chance that there's going to be a group who will not be so kind and fair. And the way to counteract that is to get on the side of lower income renters and lower to mid-income renters and homeowners, get on their side some good guidance and advice, like New Hampshire Legal Assistance, because that will give all lenders and all landlords some caution to try to treat people fairly and don't get too aggressive. And so I think it's helpful when you mention that to see that almost every one of these line items on this spreadsheet is designed to try and define a specific area in our economy. And it's such a complex web of relationships where we see potential failure points and provide resources to government and other intermediaries to move in and try and stabilize, at least on a bridge basis, until we can get to a more stable place. And I really wanted to just say to this group, I had the pleasure of working with Donna Lee as we talked through some of these, how happy I am to be working with you, because I actually think our list here is a little bit more programmatic and targeted than some of the excellent priority work that the Legislative Advisory Board did, and I think it adds to providing a whole picture of advice and support to Gopher, which is our charter, which is our mission here. And so I want to thank Donna Lee for putting this out there. That's pretty risky because, you know, there's always a risk that we've missed something in communication with our fellow colleagues. But I also want to thank the group for trying to be very smart about finding those special spots where we can have government resources come in targeted, you know, and help people at the breakdown point. So thank you very much for the chance to work with you all.
Thanks, Bill. Joe, anybody?
Donnelly, we have a few hands raised. The first one from Dean. Go ahead, Dean.
Thank you, Joe. I was going to say a few of the things that Bill said, so I'm not going to sort of belabor the point. I did want to note that the value of having existing organizations that have experience in particular areas and can provide support to people really is very critical, and I do agree with Bill that I think it's a really important part of our framework here that may not be obvious in some other conversations. And his reference to New Hampshire Legal Assistance, I would just sort of elaborate on a little in that the last time we all went through a significant period where there was a risk of foreclosures, for instance, the presence of legal services that were available to people was critical to keeping people in their homes. And I think that we learned from that experience, and it makes a lot of sense to apply that knowledge again in a circumstance like this. And I think that's what we're trying to do. Thank you.
Thanks, Dean. And I would agree, and I didn't mean to give it short shrift. I just meant that when you look at the helping organizations for the kind of things we're talking about, they're the only one I'm aware of that do that. So, Joe, who else do we have?
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Holly. Go ahead, Holly.
Just one quick question about the training for displaced workers. We spoke about it briefly in the past. Would that fit in here? Is that something we want to address?
I don't think we need to address it. I think it's covered under the federal legislation related to dislocated workers that is already funded in the state.
Okay.
And
thank
Donnelly,
you for continuing to think about that.
And Donnelly, I was able to chat with folks at in the Office of Workforce Opportunity today And so I think there's a lot of work that's going to be done. I think the federal government is putting a focus on that. So through separate programming like the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act and the work of, grants, I think the Job Training Fund, over at Employment Security, because they're not, busy enough. They're doing great work over there with those programs. So I think there's a lot of state efforts being put into place, and I think more will come as well. I think they're, we're tracking to the best that we can, because it's an ever-evolving situation, the different federal funds and other funds coming into the state. So we'll definitely try to keep an eye on it holistically as well to the best that we can.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Joe, and I appreciate you looking further into it. I just had some confidence based on what I've seen in the at least 15, if not more, years that the states have had those funds for workforce, that it's very comprehensive. And when there's a crisis, I mean, we just saw it recently with the substance abuse problem, that funds came in specifically as it related to workforce for that, because it was an identified need and people were hearing about it and changing it. So what I meant by that is I think there are going to be funds outside of the CARES Act funds, as I think you're saying as well, to help us in those efforts. Is there anything further?
Donnelly, this is Joe. It doesn't appear that we have any other hands raised, but if I can ask real fast, has Jeff Myers or Amy LaBelle joined us? Just for the purposes of the minutes, I just want to double check for attendance. Jeff Myers or Amy LaBelle? Nope. Thanks, Donnelly, and no further hands raised.
Thank you, Joe. So it sounds like we're heading in a direction that people are feeling comfortable with, that we're capturing the conversations and people's concerns. So I guess what I would propose is that I work towards trying to put together, make some of these adjustments that we discussed today, work towards getting a draft letter that is the narrative to this document, and trying to get it to the board before Tuesday's meeting for people to take a look at and review, and then we can see where we might go from there. We do have tourism and hospitality on deck for Tuesday. I'd like to thank Ben for working on putting that together. If anybody has anything else that they want to make sure that we consider or add to any of this, I'm all ears. Okay. Well, with that, I'm not aware of any other business. Does anybody have any other business they'd like to bring before the group? Okay, it doesn't sound like there is. Thank you, everybody. Again, truly, I'm grateful to Bill for all of his work, and I'm grateful to the board for taking the time to look closely at the documents that we send you for your review and your input. Our work is only as good as we are collectively, so I appreciate it very much. And with that, I hope people have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining a duly noticed meeting of the Stakeholder Advisory Board. The meeting has been run in a manner compliant with RSA 91A. This meeting has been recorded. Looking at the time, it is 3:45 p.m., and the recording will stop. Thank you very much.